My name is Tom Chick. You're listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. We're going to start giggling early.
That was a snort.
Yeah, it was a snort of derision, but an affectionate one, that's possible.
I am here with Christian Moronsky. I think, I got it right this time, didn't I?
Yes, Moronsky. I prefer to be called Yuri Karpov, though.
Spoiler, but good. And I'm also here with Kelly Wand. Kelly, do you have a tagline this week, a new one?
Well, I don't have one for myself, but I have... Oh, good, thank you. we were talking last week about how the catchphrase for this movie we're talking about tonight, 2012, right, had a really retarded catchphrase, which is, we should have listened, mm-hmm, which I believe you said they changed.
Yeah, we were warned.
Okay, we were warned. Same thing. Doesn't make any sense. But so I have a couple new catchphrases for 2012 I'd like to pitch the listeners and the filmmakers.
But now before you do that, hold on. I just want to warn anyone listening what we're all about, in case you don't know. This is a spoiler-ridden podcast. We are going to assume that you have seen the movie. So if you have not seen 2012 and you don't want things given away...
I actually think in this case that wouldn't matter.
Well, what we will give away, it's terrible. It sucks.
You've seen any Roland Emmerich movie, you've seen 2012, just not as expensive.
But maybe some people care about that, though. So that's what we're going to be doing tonight. We'll be giving spoilers away. So, Kelly, what are some alternative...
Okay, these are our catchphrases for 2012 that we'd like to see, to do a little Mad Magazine. see it soon, Ami.
Huh? Good.
John F. Kennedy landed on us. You have to see that to get it.
That's actually in the trailer. The trailer shows the
Denzel Washington,
the Kennedy landing on the White House.
Right, from that movie where Denzel Washington played Kennedy. And the third one is, if you like Roland Emmerich disaster movies, you're an idiot.
Very good. I like those.
Thank you.
Those all work out
material.
Very well.
I wrote some material.
Now, it seems like you don't have a lot of...
Unlike Roland Emmerich.
No.
Snap.
Well, it sounds like you don't have a lot of respect for the movie.
I thought that much like NRL, The End of the World felt like it was taking forever and ever.
The movie was 2 hours and I think 42 minutes.
Yeah, it's as long as a Godfather movie.
Yeah.
But without any of the characterization.
So, okay. All right. So would it be safe to assume you didn't like it?
I really wanted to see it because I felt it was the second half of the Con Air reunion that Knowing was the first half of, because Nick Cage is in Knowing and Cusack, America's third favorite Cusack, is in this one. Like, you watch both of, you know how they always make two movies about the same thing, like Deep Impact.
And nice.
This is the Armageddon to the Deep Impact of Knowing, which I think I alone have seen. And by I alone, I mean not just to the podcast. But
No, Tom's.
I have seen Knowing, yeah. And I know Dingus has seen excerpts or one excerpt in specific from Knowing.
Well, if you've seen any excerpt, you've seen the whole movie.
There are parts of Knowing that are worth sort of lifting out, I think.
Hey, I have another catchphrase. I just
thought. Okay, go.
Best Roland Emmerich disaster movie since Y2K.
I like the other three better.
Because he always does a date as the name.
Was that your 3x3, by the way?
No. Is it time for that yet?
We could just move on to that. But I think there's stuff to be said about this movie.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree.
There's more to say about the movie than there was said in the movie.
That's true. And I wrote freaking pages about this movie. I can't believe it.
So, Dingus, you really liked it. You were a big fan of it.
No, we didn't.
I'm more interested in the fact that you just put your cards on the table before we even got the topic underway, Tom. That was amazing.
What cards did I put on the table?
You said spoilers. This movie is terrible, and you.
Oh.
Well, that might have been a trick. Tom is capable.
Well, I don't think anybody expects 2012 is not going to be terrible. I mean, I knew going in it was going to be terrible. I think anybody—that's not a spoiler. Anybody who goes to see 2012 knows it's going to be terrible. The surprise, the twist, the sort of reveal. Is how terrible it is.
It's very expensively terrible. And people go to this, and the defense you always hear about movies like this is, well, the effects are amazing. Don't go for the dialogue, because the dialogue sucks. But the effect, oh, God, it's so great. Man, when he when he blew up the White House, forget that. This time it's the Washington Monument. It's totally different. It's awesome. Brilliant.
And I would disagree with that. The effects didn't do a lot for me.
Yeah, me neither. I was really surprised at how crappy a lot of the effects looked. I was stunned by that. I mean, it's a lot of just pictures of huge pieces of rocks and dirt.
No, where he's driving through L.A., that part.
That was the one part
I was paying attention to.
I gotta say, that's when I realized the moment, Kelly, when there's that overhead shot of the limo starting that, like that part of the game where he's escaping the earthquake, it just looked like a cartoon, and it looks like a fish, a big carp swimming up a river or a ditch, and as soon as I saw that, I realized, yeah, I'm watching a cartoon. Who cares?
Right. Well, then you've waited half an hour.
And I think that sequence, though, that was the first and last moment that I had any interest in the movie, because that sequence showed a little bit of spirit. You know, the goofy things like crashing through the skyscraper and barely making it under the overpass.
It actually became fun for a second.
But for a very brief moment, and here's why. All the other effects, and I noticed, too, during the credits, there were like a half dozen like CG houses, like separate studios working on this movie. So I'm guessing they would just farm out entire sequences. Okay, you do the tidal wave in the Himalayas. You do
the crack starting in this substance, and you do the crack starting in this substance.
I mean, it was clearly like different groups. And the group that did that, I would be curious to know actually who did the limo escape from L.A. Because that I enjoyed, and that had some spirit. Maybe I just had gotten worn down by the time the movie was over. But my theory is that the reason that was better than the rest of the effect sequences was that when you just see a big overview of a ruined city, like from on high, or when you see those, when you see like the cracks, like Las Vegas falling into cracks, or the tsunami hitting Washington, or coming over the Mount Everest, or whatever, when you're seeing stuff like that from on high, it's not really, it sort of loses some of its impact versus when versus when you're down in it. It feels like, in which case, it's more like a video game or a ride, you know, something at Universal Studios. And I think what it reminded me of is that one movie that realized that, and part of what it takes to have this in a movie is a real director. And Roland Emmerich, I mean, is that guy 14 or what? What? God. So I think the movie that most appreciates that, where I sort of realized it, was Spielberg's War of the Worlds, which never... It once cheats with a big overhead view, like a God's eye view of the action. But War of the Worlds is always and entirely what Tom Cruise can see.
Yes.
And this movie had no appreciation for that concept.
But it did have the troubled father-son story arc that every single Roland Emmerich movie has, and that War of the Worlds has, and that every other movie has.
Well, it's a good thing to sort of reconcile a relationship, the end of an apocalypse can break.
I'm so tired of it. Why can't they just? It's in every movie, and the estranged lovers come together, and you know the ex-husband's going to get killed, so they can come back together. And I don't know. Just once, I'd like to see like a father son in a disaster movie, and they start out they love each other, but then the disaster makes them hate each other.
I like that. That's a good twist.
Just one time, just to prove we can do it, and one of the kids dies, just to say. This is the one where the kid dies. That's what separates it from the
dog. And the dog. I think we should. It's time to start killing the dog.
Does Roland Emmerich know we've seen his other movies and we thought they were really dumb?
I don't think he does.
Well, he knows we've seen them because he chooses to destroy inconsequential things because he figures, well, I've already destroyed the U.S. Bank Tower in Los Angeles, so I'm just going to destroy a bunch of crappy buildings nobody's ever seen before and a bunch of cities nobody cares about rather than destroying anything iconic.
Wait, whoa. He dumped the Pope on everyone. What are you talking about?
And the Washington Monument.
And
there was tons of that. But they wouldn't do a mosque because they were scared.
Is that?
Yeah, but the destruction of Los Angeles is just, ugh, come on.
Well, there's nothing in there's nothing architecturally in Los Angeles that's worth seeing.
That's a point. Once you've
set those LAX spires.
That's exactly the point. And I'm just
I think he hates LA though, because he keeps trashing it like with a certain like that's the best part of this movie. Like, is when he's destroying L.A., he seems kind of passionate, and he kind of infects you with it.
I don't think – that's giving him way too much credit.
That's all just
– I have to have liked it for a reason, because nothing else was good.
Well, that's all just for the convenient the convenient payoff of the Woody Harrelson line about liberals in Hollywood. That's all that is.
And come on, Dingus, the Sistine Chapel, neatly cracking the hand of God in Adam. I mean, how awesome was that? That was iconic.
Yeah, and
notice no Mayan or Hopi architecture got destroyed because they
and, and the Jesus over Rio.
Yeah, that's right. He destroyed Jesus over Rio. His arms fell off and then he fell over to the right. That was sad. Poor Jesus. So Kelly, is it true that there was some talk about like did they consciously avoid trashing a mosque? I mean, nobody in the U.S. is going to recognize a specific mosque, but is that true?
They wanted to do the Kaaba, which is some famous mosque,
right?
But they were scared a fatwa would be issued against them, so they didn't do it.
Wow, that's
but awesome. They're not scared of the Catholics, and now the Catholics are mad at them. You know, I've noticed religious institutions only get mad when it's their institution that gets destroyed.
Wait, are Catholics mad about the whole Pope? Is that, what is that, St. Peter's Basilica? Like that? Are they mad about that whole thing?
Yeah, they moved the Sistine Chapel into St. Peter's for this one scene. So they could destroy two things with one.
I don't know. What do you call that place where the Pope addresses people?
Well, you're a theologian. You're supposed to tell us. You're going to tell us the Mayan stuff, too, because you know you studied all that when you weren't studying Jews and paranormal activity. And
I don't know what you call it where the Pope comes out and talks to people. I thought that was...
The vestibule. The royal vestibule.
No, the vestibule is where they...
It's the archetype.
It's Fox News.
Well, anyway, so Catholics are really mad about that, Kelly Wand?
Yeah, I read that somewhere, so it's true.
Okay. So who? Dingus.
Okay.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead. I cut you off.
Me? I wanted to say, I wanted to ask, what was your favorite dumb thing in the story in this movie?
It's a very good question. My favorite dumb thing was probably Zlatko Buric.
I take it he's the Russian guy.
Yeah, and he's awesome. Anybody who's seen the Pusher movies knows who he is, and he's especially amazing in the third one. You cannot come out of those three movies and not adore that fella. So my favorite dumb thing was him sacrificing himself to throw one of his Augustus loops up on the boat.
Yeah.
What was your favorite?
Then he dives nobly into the crevice.
Yeah. What was your favorite thing, Kelly Wand? Your favorite.
My favorite thing was that John Cusack was this failed writer who's now found the second career being a nanny for a Russian billionaire.
Like, how does that job transition work?
Yeah, and that's supposed to make him good with kids, even though his relations with his own kids suck. That's his job. But anyway, and then he drives from L.A. to Yellowstone and back for the weekend. He got from L.A. to Wyoming like that night.
In a day.
And then came back. And then they have to go back to Yellowstone to listen to Woody Harrelson and get his map.
Right.
And then they have to – what I would have wanted is for them to look at the map and go, oh, the Arcs are in L.A. We have to go back again. They could have done two full trips.
Dingus, what was your favorite dumb thing?
In a movie full of amazing, hey, are you that guy moments is just when when the doctor says, are you that Jackson Curtis who wrote Lost Atlantis or whatever it is? Everybody knows everybody in this movie, and then they constantly run into each other. I love that.
Now, did you like that one, that dumb moment, better than the one at the end on the ship where he sees them on the television camera being drowned in the big compartment, and he's like, hey, I know those kids.
I got more joy out of laughing at the latter moment that you just mentioned, but I knew that was coming. You know that he's going to get to come on the ship because of Chiwetel Ejiofor. I don't know how to say his name, and I apologize. But that moment when they're in the in Yellowstone, and they've stumbled into this camp, and this doctor geologist from the White House says, "Wait a minute, are you that Jackson Curtis?
I'm one of the 100 people who read your book."
I just
stand down, Sergeant. Don't shoot this family. they're just totally welcome on this. He sees his daughter going over like a potentially electrified fence, and then instead of like, honey, don't go there near there, he leads them onto this place. I don't know. Well, he's a gadfly who believes in the Jimmy Stewart spirit. Like, what's his deal? What did he write? Did you read? They read the end of his novel, and it's something about we're all neighbors in Wisconsin.
It was about astronauts on the Atlantis who, I presume, something had gone wrong, and they're doomed. And while they're sailing to their death out in space, or like a ground control to Major Tom thing, I don't know, they realize that they all know someone in Wisconsin.
Oh, because I thought it was about Atlantis, and that's what, and that was the Mayan Atlantis.
It's the shuttle Atlantis. I thought, maybe I'm mistaken.
No, that makes more sense. But there's the other Wisconsin reference that Wisconsin becomes the new South.
That's right. Pole. Yeah.
Right. Right.
So
right.
We all have neighbors at the South Pole. What's that mean? Roland Emmerich, what's that mean?
And so they're flying to China, and they're going to have to ditch in the water, but China comes to them.
Right.
Oh, about that? Just like Nixon.
What about the scene where Oliver – oh, by the way, this is supposed to be a TV series. Did you guys know that?
For real. Are you lying? Really?
No, I read that. This is part of his – he's going to make two more Independence Day movies and a TV series about this. So that
no,
Oliver,
no. You're thinking of Zombieland.
Yeah, you're totally thinking of Zombieland.
Remember the Oliver Platt character – goes to Adrian. Is that Chai Whittle's name?
Chiwetel Ejiofor is, I don't know.
Okay, so the guy who discovers that all this is going to happen, the Indian guy, he gets killed in a tidal wave, and his friend's upset about that, and Oliver Platt goes, hey, we couldn't get everyone here. I mean, would you trade places with one of these Chinese workers? And then the president's daughter rolls her eyes like, yeah, come on, you wouldn't trade places with a Chinese person. And that's how that scene ends. And then later, the Chinese workers like let Cusack's family in, that guy at the gate, and the Chinese mom take pity on Whitey and let them in. So it's like the Chinese workers get screwed twice.
There's a lot of interesting class and racial issues in this movie.
Yeah. Roland Emmerich's a deep thinker.
So
you're right.
What was your favorite instance of product placement?
We're going to need a bigger plane.
Oh, my God. Wow. Yeah, that was something else.
The audience didn't laugh at that. I don't think they even knew he was ripping off Jaws.
Right, right.
Two people in my audience laughed at it.
That's true. That's true, yes. Two people,
And I thought of you, Kelly. Mm-hmm. I thought of you and your wonderful tagline from last week or the week before that.
Yeah, now see if people listen to podcasts, they'll think, oh, he ripped off Roland Emmerich.
They'll think Roland Emmerich ripped off you, which is actually probably true.
Well, he rips off way better writers than me.
No.
He wrote the script, and so
no. You know who wrote the script?
Who?
The writer is the same guy who did the crappy soundtrack.
That's not true.
Oh yes, it
That's
is.
That's awesome. And Dingus, who sang the final credit song?
No, I don't know. No,
you said you recognized the name. I don't know the name, but you said you knew who that guy was.
It was that...
Eddie Albert or something.
Adams, the American Idol guy. He sang one of the last two songs. Adam...
Harold Closer.
Yes, that's
You're right. Oh, my God. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So he co-wrote the script with Roland Emmerich, and then he was like, hey, Roland, I'll do the music, too. I mean...
No, he's done a ton of bad music.
Oh, so he's a composer, and he's like, hey, Roland,
so
let's write a script.
To expand his badness to a new art form.
Yeah, it really is that. And
Roland Emmerich's
really
already a bad writer just by himself, so he gets a co-writer who's a bad musician.
Well, you know, I kind of have been working on a theory over the last day and a half since seeing it to try to justify spending 2 hours and 45 minutes in there. And my theory is that this movie was intended to be a parody of disaster movies. And so I'm choosing to give it a whole new genre and call it a stealth parody. I think it's a failed stealth parody, but I think this movie is far too big budget to be an actual parody of disaster movies. But it comes so close to that line that I so desperately want to be the person who loves it and gives it the benefit of the doubt to say that it's actually trying to be a parody of disaster movies, and that this guy who writes crappy music for a lot of disaster pictures said, hey, Roland, I've got this idea. Just look at my script, but
that's giving it a lot of credit. I think
do intentions matter when it comes to art?
Oh, we can't. Well, I look at a couple of things about this movie. The fact that the repetition is almost, well, it's not even almost, is comical.
Yeah, there's like 9 different scenes where someone's saying goodbye on the phone and then the line goes dead.
It's not only that, it's you've got the limo escaping a crack in the earth, then you've got a
plane outrunning the volcano.
And then you've got a bigger car, an RV, escaping. And then you've got a bigger plane doing the same thing. And you've got this almost shot for shot, the same shots of a plane going between two buildings that are collapsing more than once. It's just stunning to me that you can have that kind of repetition in this expensive a movie when repetition in film is just death. And then there's this one wonderful moment, and then I'll get off this ridiculous thing I'm talking about. There's this one
I want to believe your theory, but I can't make that last leap. I'm clawing at it.
Well, there's this wonderful moment where it's just awful, where Oliver Platt is in the White House and talking to Doctor. Did you say his name is Adrian? I think.
Doctor.
And there at the end, there's this intense conversation, and he says something like, "She's pretty hot, huh?" Yeah. And there's this goofy, like, music in the background, like, do-do-do-do-do. And I'm like, we're supposed to laugh at all
of
that.
Yeah, and at the end, they're all cheery and making dates with each other on this art. Like, they're the last survivors of humanity, but they're kind of like, they don't even talk about any of the dead people that we've just seen. It's so cheery. It's weird.
Anyway, I want to believe that there's something else going on here, but I really don't think there is.
Is this better than Day After Tomorrow?
Yeah.
Really?
I actually don't think it is. And I don't remember much about Day After Tomorrow, but I remember seeing it and thinking this isn't as bad as I was expecting it to be.
Wow. Okay.
No, this is better. Because Day After Tomorrow's third act is wolves, which isn't very exciting.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Fighting wolves on a boat. Well, as on this, it's the 19th tidal wave you've seen, so that's way better.
Oh, my God, and the scene, like, straight out of... Was it even cool when they did that in Deep Impact, where the two people are, like, holding themselves as the big old tidal wave comes up on them? Like, was it stupid back then, or did it just get stupid in this movie?
Well, I'm a Deep Impact apologist. I know that. We are on opposite sides of the Armageddon Deep Impact rift or chasm, or whatever you want to call it.
I think you're both dumb, and they both suck.
Of course they do, but one has to be better than the other.
But that moment in Deep Impact works, though, where Tilioni and Maximilian
Schell
are on the beach, yeah, and they've finally reconciled as the wave is coming in. Like, that moment works, right?
Oh, yeah, it does. Because, yeah, it's a great moment.
And isn't there stuff in Deep Impact 2 about, like, there's one point where I think Morgan Freeman says, we should have had a lottery. Or he says his dying wife, or not, good Lord, Morgan Freeman, Danny Glover says, Morgan Freeman was president in Deep Impact, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay, where Danny Glover says, my wife says we should have had a lottery. Wasn't a big part of Deep Impact about how they had a lottery?
Yeah. But the main characters all had tickets, and you never get to see the inside of the supply sheds.
Right. But it wasn't where you buy your way in. Like, it was a moral quandary. What do we do when we know the world's going to end? We have a lottery about how many people can be saved. Wasn't that the core premise of Deep Impact?
Yeah. Okay. So that makes this one worse in a way, because the rich just get on, and it's never really addressed.
Well, you know, it's really stupid. Like, this movie pretended to have moral quandaries, and they were just so juvenile that they, you know, my favorite dumb moment, I'm going to change my answer, was Chiwetel Ejiofor and Oliver Platt having this 11th hour, you know, the very last minute debate in front of the leaders of the world, just at the lowest, stupidest level of, do we save everyone or do we only save a few people? And you know the movie isn't going to make, you know, there's going to be no meaningful choice. It's not something you have to think about. There's going to be no consequence. It's obviously going to be this safe message about, yeah, save everyone. But, you know, Oliver Platt in a real movie would have very good points. He wouldn't be the oily villain. He would be the voice of reason, and he would provide you with stuff you should think about. And at least Deep Impact did that.
And it also, the female lead gave her life away meaninglessly in Deep Impact. While as in this movie, everyone you think's going to die dies, and everyone you think's going to live lives.
I thought briefly they might kill John Cusack, but I guess
and the kid. Or the kid.
I knew they weren't. Well, the moment I saw the kid swimming down there, I was like, oh, I guess more.
No, wouldn't that have been awesome, though? Like, if the kid had been the noble sacrifice. Like, because his death would have been shocking.
I knew, but at that point in the movie, once they're saving the dog, I know no kid is going to die.
No one can die.
Well, I did think, okay, hey, maybe they'll martyr John Cusack.
Like they did with Bruce Willis in Armageddon, your favorite.
Exactly.
Movie,
which
if they hadn't done, you would hate that movie.
There's many things that they did that got a lot of goodwill from me in Armageddon, and that was one of them.
Has Roland Emmerich, in any of his movies, ever shown blood, ever? Has he ever shown a dead body, ever? Is there a single dead body in this
there
movie?
There is a bloody dead body, the pilot, when they come to the airport. It was sort of odd. Is you see the pilot he's hired, like, laying there as this bloody corpse. And that's another thing, too. They're just going to show that the only reason that's in there isn't because he thinks, hey, let's have a bloody dead body. It's because he thinks, hey, we need to show that Gordon can fly a plane. You know, it's sort of like, oh, we need to make sure he's going to be the pilot. So
then once they don't need him anymore, he dies.
Well, I
gives a speech to John Cusack about how lucky John Cusack is to have a family, even though this guy's married to his family.
Do you know who that guy was, Kelly Wand?
No.
His name is Tom McCarthy. Does that ring any bells?
Yeah, he's the director.
Yeah, right? So he's a character actor, like a TV actor, but he directed Station Agent and The Visitor, and he co-wrote Up, the Pixar movie. So
why is he in this piece?
He's in this piece of junk so that he can do those movies. You know, he's going to get it. He's going to cash in and do this. And
Up didn't pay enough. He has to do this.
It's not easy to get to direct your own film after you've directed Station Agent and The Visitor. No matter how beautiful those films are, they're not, you know, they're not those margin movies.
It always helps to have a 2012 on your resume.
Well, just if you can have that money, go for it, buddy. I am totally in support of that.
Yeah, and I don't think it's having a 2012 on your resume. It's having those 2012 residual checks in your mailbox. I think that's the more important thing. So I was glad to find that was him. I mean, and there were Chiwetel Ejiofor, I love him, and there are a few moments where I thought, okay, you know, he's really trying, and he's putting his heart in it, and he's doing his best, but that stupid debate with Oliver Platt at the end, I just felt so bad for the guy. I mean, nobody, with the possible exception of Daniel Day-Lewis, could have pulled that off.
Well, you know, what if, and I just thought of this as you were talking about it, Tom, what if they had the balls to have the president give that talk, and instead of having him have his noble end, if you have this, okay, we're going to have a black president every time the world is destroyed kind of an idea, have the black president really have these types of ideology.
Or it's about him. He has to make the hard decisions. And it's
He's arguing Oliver Platt's position, but from a position of pragmatism instead of, like Tom said, this oily villain. And it's these two men who really have a strong feeling about it going head to head.
Yeah.
Instead of just letting him sneak out the other door and just die nobly, have him stand up for what he believes in.
It's not even nobly. He just decides to stay instead of – I mean, if they call it, oh, it's a captain staying with his sinking ship. Well, his ship's still – it's the Ark, so he should be on that.
That's a good point. Hey, let me ask you guys this. Did you know they were going to be arcs? Did you both know they were going to be arcs, or did you?
That's a reveal.
Okay, good. Because I was sort of hanging on for the hope of.
I knew when I heard one character's name was Noah that there was going to be arc coming up. Just like when I saw that there was a black main character guy and a black main character girl, and of course they hook up.
Yeah, that's the rule. But Dingus, you're right. It did seem they definitely were teasing that it was going to be spaceships, and it's a reveal when it turns out that they're, you know, that's when the little kid says, "Why does it have anchors?" And but here's the thing: in the trailer, they show them floating around in the water, and they even say the line about, you know, there's ships. We have to get to the ships, and then they give away that they're boats in the trailer, which is stupid.
Oh, that's idiotic. That's one of the only things I really liked about the movie was finding out they were going to be arcs, and it sort of shifted my expectations because I was wondering how ridiculous it could possibly get. And
I thought they were spaceships even till the end when they didn't take off. I thought they were just going to launch from the water because the whole planet was going to be destroyed.
The abyss aliens were going to take them up, actually. And I kept hoping for a monster to sneak in.
Oh, we need it. Because that's the thing in Day After Tomorrow. We got those wolves with – didn't they even have red glowy eyes or something? But here, yeah, like no monsters. There should have been like a giant squid coming in the tidal wave or something. Or yeah.
Yeah, they unleashed something.
I was hoping for that as well.
But no. And it's not really the end of the world because Africa's still there. And they just have to they have to float.
Well, we go back.
So wouldn't anyone in a big boat have been okay if they weren't near one of the main areas?
Okay, but, well, humanity goes back to Africa, you see.
Yeah, I get it.
Where we came from. So back. That's what water themes are always about, rebirth.
This all took place in the past. See? And this is our origin. And they're the Adam and Eve. Yeah. See what they did there?
Nice.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Dingus, you were going to ask, are we what?
I wasn't certain there at the end. They said something about, you know, there's that whole ridiculous, oh, don't, hey, it looks like the water's receding much quicker than we thought. And then
they've been wrong every other time up till
now. Right. And then Africa has been raised up and maybe didn't even flood. So are we supposed to think that Africa's just was fine for the whole movie and they're going to show up and say, hey, we're the rest of the world, Africa, can we live here?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's that everybody's been killed. It's totally like a – because I think it was – wasn't it the floodwaters receding from Africa?
Well, no, it's the floodwaters receding from everywhere else, but it seems like there was this line sort of snuck in there, this sort of look out for snakes kind of line, where they say Africa's been raised up, and somebody seems to say from the side, and maybe it didn't even flood. But I'm not – maybe I'm just imagining.
I think that would – if they wanted this idea that only Africa, you know, a third world country survived, I think they would have made that more explicit. I mean, he definitely would – he would have hit you over the head with that if that was the point.
Very good point. Very good point.
So let's talk about poor George Segal did not get his father-son reconciliation that everybody else got in the movie because he had bad timing. It's like, hey, can I talk to my son? I want to hello? You know, that was like, you know, oh, my God, just a matter of timing. And George Segal,
great use.
Oh, my God. Poor George Segal.
Well, he was a jazz musician, so at least you got to hear him play jazz. Oh, wait, didn't. I liked how everything in that room was on wheels, too.
You would think they wouldn't do that on a ship.
Yeah. Or that the kitchen has immediate access to the deck.
Yes. And what, I mean, talk about being derivative. Yeah. I mean, it totally does a Poseidon Adventure. I mean, it shows the ship going upside down. Everything in this movie has been done before. Every single thing.
Well, that's what's so great about it, and another thing.
Stealth parody.
My stealth parody idea is that it's just a greatest hits of disaster films.
Now
you have all the meteors falling out of the sky with the it's not a volcano. I forget what technical term.
Caldera.
They used for Yellowstone.
The caldera.
The caldera.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Is there a difference between? And I think the answer is yes, but let's talk about it. Between disaster movies and end-of-the-world movies?
Just scale.
I disagree. So here's the deal. I think this was primarily a disaster movie. In the tradition of those crappy Irwin Allen things, where you've got a large cast, most of the people are disposable, they're going to kill a few, but they want to have a hopeful ending. Those are the sort of the tenets of a classic disaster movie. And it's full of like gimmicks and effects stuff and, you know, whereas an end of the world movie, I think movies about the end of the world, about the apocalypse, tend to be more sort of personal. Like I think of things like, and it doesn't even have to be post-apocalyptic, but I think of I Am Legend is about Will Smith's character through the end of the world. You know, when the world ends, the world ends. That's a completely different issue than, hey, we just had this.
The world
big,
never ends.
That's a completely different issue than, hey, we just had this big traumatic event, and now we've come out on the other side, and we're going to let the audience go home hopeful. That's a disaster movie. An end of the world movie is how does somebody deal with everything in civilization being lost? And that's something that is not at all even touched on in Roland Emmerich's movies.
Well, it's not in I Am Legend. It turns out not to be the end of the world either, because there's this whole community of people living in Vermont.
But I disagree. I think, I mean, that ending, and you yourself said in an earlier podcast, Kelly, that it felt out of place. It didn't fit. I Am Legend is very much about Will Smith and not a cast of characters and sort of a feel-good ride to a hopeful ending. I mean, it's very much about him adjusting to the loss of civilization.
And the hopeful ending is them reaching Vermont. There's a kid and a woman and a church.
But it's not a cast of characters. I mean, do you sort of, if you disagree, that's cool, but do you sort of see what I'm seeing or saying, or you just don't?
Only when about the ensemble cast. I think that seems to be a disaster movie.
Have you seen a movie called The Day the Earth Caught Fire?
No, sounds good, though.
The Day the Earth Caught Fire is good, and I think it's one of my favorite end-of-the-world movies. It's actually from the 60s, maybe. I think it's black and white. It's British. And I think it's another classic end-of-the-world movie. And it's got another, like, I think he's an estranged father, if I'm not mistaken. It might have done that way before anyone else was doing it. But it's what things like The Day After Tomorrow should have been. There's been, I forget what kicks it off, but I think it's like solar flares start heating up the world. And it's all told through the perspective of one newspaperman over the course of the few days that this happens. And the ending of The Day the Earth Caught Fire, I won't spoil it because I really think you guys should see it. The ending of The Day the Earth Caught Fire is a beautiful thing. So I just think,
well, Tom,
go ahead, Dingus.
Tom, where are you going to put the 28 Days, Weeks Later movies?
Well, I think the classic zombie apocalypses are very much end-of-the-world movies. Like, how do people deal with – I mean, the whole zombie layer screws it up. But those kind of things, like, how do people deal with the loss of civilization? How do you – that's something completely different than how do we deal with, crap, the building's on fire, let's get out.
But does it matter that civilization exists? It's just not – it's just hard to get to. As opposed to, it's never going to come back, that sense of hopelessness.
Well, an end-of-the-world movie can have a hopeful ending. I'm not saying...
They tend to, and that's why...
Well, you know what? Zombie movies classically don't. You know, like Night of the Living Dead, where everybody dies.
Night of the Living Dead's a good example, too, of a movie where the characters can't work together, and, like, the villain, the guy you like the least, that bald guy, the dad, he's actually saying the one smart thing, which is they should stay in the basement.
And that, I think, is...
Then they only have one choke point, which you learn from Left 4 Dead. But it's like, that's failure to cooperate winds up killing them.
And all of that is stuff that I think is classic end-of-the-world stuff rather than let's just have a disaster.
Well,
That's okay. I think 2012 wants us to think it's reaching for some of that, because I like where you're going with this, Tom. I particularly like the idea of staying with one or a couple of characters and sticking with them, and then sort of writing it out with them to see how civilization crumbles. Because there is this moment in my favorite ridiculous scene where the doctor is asking John Cusack, do you really think people would react this way? Because his novel has this hopeful idea when society is crumbling, I think. That's the suggestion. And I kept waiting for us to see the opposite happen or what. And instead we see this cursory people running along the platform and accidentally pushing each other off.
Yeah.
And that's supposed to be the placeholder for civilization.
And John Cusack endangering everyone's lives by screwing up that crank and almost killing everyone. Like, and then he has to undo his own mistake. So it's like he's thinking selfishly. He's not thinking communally. If he was thinking communally, he would be the one tossing his kid up and then taking the sacrifice.
Did he break that crank?
I think he did. How else did it break? They were in there monkeying around.
But he was so good at clearing out those gears.
And he said something. Yeah. And it's suspenseful to watch some guy struggle with some kind of machinery. And you apologists.
How about those awesome computer displays? And the computer is constantly helpfully talking, providing exposition.
10 meters, 15 meters. I like that. Actually, that's stupid stuff I kind of like. It sort of warms my heart. But I don't understand. Okay, I think someone was saying earlier was that, like, disaster movies, one of their things is ensemble casts of bad acting and just and silly dialogue, and this movie's trying to embrace that. I don't understand why we need that. I understand why we need the acting to be bad and the dialogue to be crappy and no one to really feel like convey a sense of grief. I don't know why that's better. I don't know why that's expected. Like, there's your extra 45 minutes right there for the trimming room floor.
The problem, I don't know, I'm not quite sure where you're going with that, Kelly, but what it makes me think of, and you can correct me after this moment, is that axiom of how really, really good writing can save bad or amateur acting, and no amount of good acting is ever going to save bad writing. And you just see something Tom said a minute ago about how – would you say his name, the doctor's?
Adrian?
Chiwetel Ejiofor, I believe.
Thank you. How he is just being so game and just trying so hard and really just throwing his heart. You could just see it, but it's just dog paddling in quicksand. It's just sad. None of them can rise above it. Not a one of them can. And so you might as well just populate the movie with Danny Glover's rather than wasting this guy. So I'm not sure what you're saying about Kelly, about it being that bad dialogue is required. It's just that's all they.
You're saying they don't know better, but I guess that's true. But I don't know. It's like if they know, I don't know. Like, doesn't anyone know it's bad at the production stage?
Oh, I mean, with the number of people working on that movie, I'm sure they did. Yeah. I mean,
they just don't care.
They're getting paid. I mean, it's their job, and yeah, I mean, and roll
it. Their job's to make the writing as good as possible for that. I mean, I don't see why that one element has to be correct. Like the effects, they lavish hundreds of millions of dollars.
Oh, you know this, Kelly. You know the answer to this. The reason is because Roland Emmerich's movies make money. You know, he gets big budgets and he puts out big crappy movies, and they get a healthy return. So they let him keep doing that. No one's going to tell him, "Hey, your script sucks. Do a good one." Because it's not going to make a whit of difference to how much money it makes. I think everybody knows this movie's going to be terrible, and they go anyway. We went.
Yeah, but we hated it, didn't we?
Yeah.
I mean, and we knew what it was going to be, and it was exactly what we thought it was going to be.
I actually didn't know it was going to be so derivative. That's what I was hoping for. I didn't know that every single thing in this movie I had already seen before. And that was why I was a little excited during the limo drive out of L.A., I was like, okay, this is kind of cool. If we get a bunch of stuff like this, it's sort of clever and spirited, it will have been 2 hours and 42 minutes worth spending. But
then it's the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
And I was just stunned by that. I mean, Tom, you mentioned all the different effects houses listed at the end. And what I was struck by is that it used to be that you would see – or at least I remember on a couple of movies, specific sequences attributed to specific special effects houses. They would list, like, this effects sequence was done by this house. And at the end of the credit sequence, there is this catch-all moment where it's – and these people also worked on it. It's just a list of these effects houses that, like you said, must have just been tossed. Here, you handle this. You handle that. You handle this. And it kind of had the feeling of they wound up with a bunch of effects, and they kind of looked and said, boy, these are all the same. Oh, well, just –
yeah,
let's intercut it with scenes of phones going dead.
Actually, that's a good point, Dingus.
My
I mean,
huge name actor.
If Roland Emmerich just gives him the script and says, "Okay, and here's the part where we have Las Vegas fall apart," you know, and there's cracks opening in the world. How many things can you do with that? And we're gonna have a plane taking off. You know, the effects houses are just gonna do what they're sort of given, and it's gonna invariably look the same because there's no creative thought behind it.
Yeah. When Cusack says we need to get a bigger plane, that's what Emmerich's thinking, and then they just get a bigger plane.
They may not have even realized that was from Jaws. Roland Emmerich might have said
someone had to have. But they didn't realize that in Jaws they did get a bigger boat, and that's what made it cool. And Emmerich goes, "Oh, wouldn't have been great." See, if he'd made Jaws, they would have gotten a bigger boat.
All right.
Now we see what Jaws would have been like.
It would have been Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus.
But I, when you said that you thought the arcs were going to be spaceships, I thought that too, just because it was the one element that we hadn't seen. And I go, oh, well, that's the only place where this is going, because the world's going to end. So they're going to run out of world. So it's going to go into outer space disasters, the asteroids, and it's going to be.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that makes me think of, there was a disaster film.
The moon, or they're going to the moon. They have to, like, where, go to the moon for a few centuries or something. Well, something where they actually have to sacrifice. Instead, they just have to stay underwater for like a month. And then Africa's there? Like, everyone in a submarine's safe, basically, right?
Well, it's not a submarine. They're just floating on the water.
But don't they submerge?
No. It's a boat. It's a big old boat. Yeah. I mean, it's supposed to be anchored when the wave hits it, and then it bobs up. You know, they let loose, and it bobs up, and it's just a boat. Dingus, what did that make you think of? You started to say.
There's another disaster movie. It's a very old movie, where they build spaceships. And they build these gigantic, like, roller coaster like ramps for them, and the world is going to burn up, and everybody gets on a spaceship and it gets launched into outer space. Is that it?
It's from the 50s, George Pal.
It's one of those 50s kind of movies.
Yeah, they're remaking that. Guess who's going to be directing that?
The guy who did District 9, Please, Please, Oh Please.
It rhymes with Roland Emmerich.
Wait, what was the original movie called? I didn't hear you.
When Worlds Collide.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right.
And then they go to another planet, and you actually see the other planet for a minute.
Yeah.
And then I guess there's a sequel in the books. There's books they were based on where they have adventures on the alien world.
Now, Kelly Wand, you're lying when you say that Roland Emmerich is doing a remake of When Worlds Collide.
Someone dumb's doing it. It's him or McGee or one of those bastards.
Yeah, that's right. And they're... That does have the sort of ridiculous, right. Like, it's like a railgun spaceship thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the millionaire can't get on board the ship. See, that movie actually had a moral. Like, you the rich couldn't buy their way on board the ships. But then in this one, in 2009, rich people made this movie. So to them, it's like, oh, we got to get on because, you know, come on. This is the real world.
Well, if it was a real movie, then there would be, you know, that would be a point.
It's Stephen Sommers is directing the remake, by the way. The guy who does those Mummy movies.
But yeah, if this was a real movie, then that would be a point. When Oliver Platt says, we needed private industry to do this, and the way we do that is we sell tickets to billionaires. I mean, that's a good point. Yeah.
But why couldn't you sell enough tickets? Why couldn't, I don't know. Well, can't you just make more arcs?
Well, that's the thing, too, that I was thinking, and that's why it's a fake out when you think it's a spaceship, is a spaceship can only carry so much weight and so much fuel to achieve escape velocity. A boat has no such limitation. So when you're thinking it's a spaceship, then that's another thing. And I kept thinking Oliver Platt just explained to him that you don't have enough fuel to launch the ships. And of course, he doesn't explain that because they're not spaceships. But yeah, with the boat, just, yeah, you're right. Just put everyone on there, especially if they know that they're going to hit land. If their projection was, you know, that the waters are going to recede and they would hit land in a while.
Within a month. When you say a while, you mean about 30 days. That's when the floods receded. Yeah. So they were put out. They were inconvenienced basically for.
And how bad do you feel for those poor people at the head of the mob who got pushed off of the precipice and like fell to their deaths at the last moment?
They all should have.
And then, you know, they'd do like, okay, we're going to lower the gate. Never mind. You can come in. Oh, the 100 or so people that fell off the edge. Too bad for those guys. That sucks.
Well, actually, Tom, that makes me think of something that I really
want to talk about.
They didn't
have a rail for some reason.
Go ahead, Dingus.
Tom, sorry. That makes me think of something I wanted to talk about. And what do you guys think about this whole – about the loss of human life in this movie, because you made points about we don't see any dead bodies other than the pilot. You see people falling off the freeway and the little girl crying about that as they fly by. You see bodies falling out of buildings, which can only evoke for me the World Trade Center. But it's just so much human fodder. And I'm wondering how you guys feel about that in this kind of movie as opposed to other movies when so many human casualties. Like, does it make you angry? Does it not bother you? What kind of movie does it make you angry in? What do you think, Tom?
What bothers me more than the bodies, none of that mattered to me. I mean, this is a time-honored thing. Ever since that poor guy fell off the bow of the Titanic and banged into the rails, you know, when the ship flips up and it's going down, like that sort of, you know what, that right there is like, okay, we can show graphic imagery of just human fodder getting killed. So that stuff doesn't really bother me. It's a little squeaky, but I'm okay with it. What bothers me is showing children watching it and reacting to it. That's what got to me, is seeing that poor little girl. And the most human moment in this stupid movie is when that adorable little monkey who played John Cusack's daughter is looking out the window in the plane, and she sees the people falling out of the building, and Amanda Peet covers her face. Like, that one shot right there is the only human moment in this movie where I felt any sort of emotion whatsoever. Does it bother you, Dingus? Like, what do you mentioned the 9/11 thing, and yeah, that's the bodies falling out of the building. That's
Well, let me shoot this same question over to Kelly first, and then I'll sort of give my opinion on it. Do you have an opinion on this, Kelly Wand?
I think you're onto something, and I think that's why the movie made me kind of uncomfortable. And I like big body counts, but the fact that the characters never seem to take it with, except for Chiwetel Ejiofor's character, like you said earlier, like he's the only one who's acting like the world's ending, and the rest are just sort of thinking of themselves or nothing. And Cusack to some extent, but just, I don't know, at the end, there's just no sense of loss or desolation.
Well, and that's part of the difference too, between a disaster movie and an end of the world movie. An end of the world movie recognizes, I think, the end of the world, the loss of civilization, the loss of life.
But isn't this supposed to be an end of the world
movie? But it's not. It's a disaster movie. That's my contention. This is not.
It's a disaster movie about the end of the world, though.
But it's not. Right. But my point is, there's a difference between a disaster movie and an end of the world movie. Just because a disaster movie is about the end of the world, it's not an end of the world movie.
You're saying having characters reacting unrealistically because of a genre convention makes it more acceptable.
I'm saying that I don't care about the casualties because the movie doesn't care about the casualties, and nobody in the movie cares about the casualties, and the casualties are only an aspect of the special effects, except for the one moment when you have the pilot with a little blood on his arm laying on the ground. Yeah. No person, there's nothing showing an actual human being injured. They're all digital images of you know, it's like the big Pope Dome. I'm pretty sure that's St. Peter's Basilica. You guys are calling me on that, I think. I'm going to look that up.
But it is from the outside, but the interior has a different
scene. Okay, right. But when the big Pope Dome crushes all those people in the crowd, it's all just a special effect, you know?
That's what annoys me about the movie, is it should show real suffering.
But that's what
of millions of people.
Right, and that's what an End of the World movie would address, I would say.
Well, then I feel gypped.
So, Dingus, how do you...
You're just showing the architecture collapsing without any of the human casualties.
But you're showing it, but you don't care about it. None of that matters. None of that's supposed
to... Wouldn't it be better if you
This is an adventure movie. It's not an end-of-the-world movie. It's about an adventure, and it's not about the collapse of civilization. You know, this adventure happens to be civilization collapsing, but that's beside the point.
It's not as good.
Oh, no, I mean, it's terrible, of course. So, Dingus, you raised this. How did you react to all of this?
Well, first of all, your clarification of this point just all of a sudden brings to mind the difference between the word enormous and enormity.
Nice.
That one person making this movie thinks that he's made a movie where there's enormity, but it's just enormous.
So explain real quick the difference between the definitions. That's relatively esoteric, I think. I don't think most people know that.
Well, one's a noun and one's an adjective.
Right? I'm going to force you to do that because that's your thing.
Well, enormous is something big, and when you use the word enormity, which most people use to mean something that's really big, that instead means something that's terrible or horrible, like the enormity of the Holocaust. Whereas you have the enormousness of an elephant or whatnot.
Enormousness?
I was trying to use them as
both
sounds.
One says that. Yeah. This is like when you told me the difference between titled and entitled. Nerd alert.
All right, we're saving that for our grammar podcast.
So go ahead.
All right. For me, I was brought back to, you know, you see – human beings treated like fodder. I think of a couple different films. I couldn't get overly upset about it in this film because of the shot I described earlier of the limousine, and when I felt like, oh, that's right, this is a cartoon. Except when you see the little girl crying, and that that brings something up in me, much like what you described, Tom. This, are you really going to, if you're going to have people falling off a building and not show us, or have the Washington Monument crush a bunch of people we never see that are just a bunch of CG little ants running around, then don't expect me to also have a feeling when this little girl cries other than being angry at you. But I couldn't get truly enraged about it the way I did when I saw the movie Pearl Harbor.
Ugh.
And I just remember just sailors being killed and dying, and this guy flipping up and smacking into a propeller on a ship that was capsizing, and just getting increasingly angry. And I would say that one is because it was based on an actual historical moment, and one is not. But I also got angry, and this is weird for me to think about this. I also got angry when I saw the third X-Men movie. Please bear with me on this. Because I just felt like human life and mutants were just treated like fodder in this. They just thrown away just for the sake of body counts. And I think that as I thought about this, it was because the first two X-Men movies, whatever else you think about them, I cared about those characters and I liked those films. And then we go into the third film and I'm with somebody who suddenly doesn't care at all about any of them.
Brett Ratner.
And I think it's this feeling of, if I think you care at all about human life, then I'm going to care about it. And if you don't, then I'm going to get angry at you. But for some reason in 2012, I didn't get enraged the way I did in Pearl Harbor, or just really angry at the way life and even mutant life is treated in X-Men 3.
It's hard to get mad at Roland Emmerich. It's like getting mad at the weather, ironically.
And you know, like as Tom says, the question is, are you 14? Am I watching something by somebody who's 14?
See, in War of the Worlds, we've talked about what makes War of the Worlds suck, like the ending. But something that I really liked about War of the Worlds was that you got a sense of panic and Tom Cruise's desperation and not knowing what was going on. And I mean, part of it's just the fact that you stay with his character, but you also. Like, they all reacted like it would be an end of the world.
Kelly Wand, our friend, I don't know if you've ever met him, Dingus and I know a fellow named Aaron Kane, who made the canny observation to us that part of what Steven Spielberg brought to War of the World was Schindler's List, and this idea of what it's like to have people treated like cattle and rounded up, and this idea of refugees and just people just who've lost all hope.
Right.
And that I think makes War of the World a bona fide end of the world movie and not just some crappy disaster adventure.
Until you see Boston unscathed at the end.
A lot of that's
you know,
the
oh, it's just some little thing.
Unfortunately, a lot of end of the world movies do pull their punches. It upsets my cat.
You can hear. But I was what another reason I felt gypped by this movie was it barely touched on any of the Mayan or Hopi stuff.
I know. I thought we would get more sort of like wacky.
I thought we'd get at least a little gobbledygook.
Yeah, yeah.
I felt gypped.
Instead, we get neutrinos from the sun heating the world's core and melting the crust. I forget what the nanoscience was, but it was awesome. I mean, it wasn't as good as like I was even kind of hoping for some kind of like crazy supernatural thing. Because then you get.
Yeah, or a Mayan curse
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, and then you could have monsters.
Right.
Yeah. Oh.
It's end of the world with. Right.
Yeah, like.
Giant
circles. Big old Quetzalcoatl.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Like that Michael Moriarty movie.
That Michael Moriarty movie is great. Don't go trashing that.
I'm not. Do you hear me trashing it?
That's Larry Cohen. That's Larry Cohen's best movie, by the way. Q.
Roland Emmerich should watch that movie and learn a thing or two.
Roland Emmerich should watch any movie and learn a thing or two.
Besides
Roland,
Spielberg.
Yeah. He should watch District 9, to be honest. Because I just keep thinking about the difference between Star Wars and Phantom Menace. How when you don't have money to throw at a problem, how you come up with interesting ideas. And that's what District 9 is to me. And just the idea of it being over an interesting city that we've never seen before and really paying attention to characters. And, hey, a father and a son who love each other. How about that? And just watch those movies and pay attention to what character means. And not only character as people, but character as place.
Yeah. As event.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I tell you guys about a story I wrote once?
Sure, Tom.
Why don't you read it?
It's called. Yeah. I could. It's very short. It's called Tri-Collision, and it's about these three ships in the ocean. Like, these two ships hit each other. I'd been reading a lot about the not the Lusitania. It was some these two ocean liners collided. One of them sank, and the other sailed back with basically the bow sheared off of the front of it. So these two ships collide in the fog, and then another ship hits one of them and swings the back of the other ship around into it. So there's three ships banged into each other like a triangle. And I had all this stuff about how one of the ships was an aircraft carrier with a big radar dish. And when it started to sink, the radar dish slid down and crushed all these people. And I think it had a character who's like an admiral or something. So I was 9 years old. I write a story called Tri-Collision. And I remember my grandmother reading it and taking me to task for it being so violent and having people like killed and whatnot. Bless her heart, awesome. my grandmother, grandmother Chick, Ruby Chick, calling me out for my tasteless use of human fodder as a 9-year-old boy in Arkansas. So
Roland Emmerich needed a grandmother.
He did. He did not have Ruby Chick to.
But didn't that make you also go, "Oh, cool! I did it right. I've offended."
If my goal had been to offend my grandmother, yes, that would have worked.
Didn't Krzysztof Kieślowski make that into a French three-part movie?
Actually, Roland is going to option it. He looked at the story and he's very interested. I'm taking lunch with him tomorrow.
Taking lunch.
I don't know if I said that right. I don't know how you
take. You're part of the taking lunch with Roland crowd now.
I pretty much know where you're going to be taking the lunch.
I don't know what that means. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with it.
I've heard of brown bagging it, but...
Oh!
Thank you.
No, wait, that... Let's pretend this is what happened.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3, feet apart, and I'm free, getting down with three.
So, this week's 3x3...
Hey, I finally figured out why you used that music on a podcast about movies. It's because Britney Spears' movie Crossroads was so influential.
Very good. You've got me. It's one of my all-time favorites.
With Ralph Macchio?
No. That's the one that's always on, though.
This week's 3x3 is your favorite instance of nudity in a movie. Not just because necessarily there's a hot chick in it or whatever, because the nudity is so appropriate or fits in well with what the scene is doing. So we've each come up with three of these. And Kelly Wan, since you will be picking our 3x3 this week, why don't you lead us off? What is your third favorite instance of nudity?
Well, see, I tried to steer away from anything Phoebe Cates related because of the, you know, that would be boring, and that's what you're trying to avoid, right? So if there's any Phoebe Cates in anyone's list.
Hold on, I got to rework my list.
Yeah, stand by.
Or Crying Game. I didn't do that either.
Okay. Can you guys give me a couple minutes?
Yeah. Okay.
Are you going to say something about Caddyshack too?
Is there nudity? Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I should have.
Is there nudity?
Cindy Please. Reynolds. Forgot about her. It's been too long. Thanks for reminding me of that. You've changed my plans for the evening. my number three favorite nudity pick... Appropriate nudity. Appropriate nudity? Is that what the phrase was?
Well, like that you just feel fits in very well with what this is. It's not just like gratuitous and thrown in. Yeah. So.
Okay. My number three is Jennifer Connelly in Requiem for a Dream because I don't know how many spoilers. It's a movie. It's a scene that kind of will be ruined if you know anything about it, but it's a scene where she goes ass to ass, I believe is the term.
Is she actually nude in that, though? I don't think there's any actual nudity in there, is there?
It shows her rump. Does that count as nudity?
Okay. I just recall
and it's
that.
It's definitely hers. I mean, I'd know that one anywhere.
Well,
can you show a clip at this point, Tom?
Yeah, let's go to the clip. I just recall that scene being more suggested than graphic. But okay.
Well, in the director's cut, it's better. And it was that scene that caused it to get it to go out into the world unrated because Darren Aronofsky wouldn't relinquish it.
Well, I have the.
So there was enough nudity in it to make a ratings difference, which means she's nude enough to make this list.
Well, the copy I have, I bought at Target, so I don't know.
Did you get the R-rated one?
You got both. I did accidentally, as soon as it came out on DVD, because Requiem for a Dream was my favorite movie that year. As soon as it came out for DVD, I intended to buy it, and I just happened to be at a Target, so I was picking up, you know, socks and whatnot. So I grabbed a copy of Requiem for a Dream, and then when I finally, you know, a few months later was going to crack the shrink wrap and watch it, saw the little tag saying it had been re-edited for some sort of a Target audience-friendly rating.
Oh. Yeah. And then you still watched it?
No. Say good Lord, no. I promptly bought the actual version.
Oh. She's barely, it's just a flicker, which makes it all the odder that caused.
Well, the thing is, she's done nudity before. She was in that thing, Mulholland Falls. She's like running around buck naked in that for.
And Hotspot, which has her and Virginia Madsen, which it should be on this list if I wasn't creepy. But Requiem for a Dream.
Okay, so that's your number three. Good.
It's Jennifer Connelly doing something butt-related, and it's completely unerotic. And so the fact that can do something like that shows the power of Aronofsky's mastery of the craft.
Good. Dingus, what's your number three?
All right. You, when you started the topic, you seemed to be fairly liberal or lenient as far as what constituted nudity or as far as what body parts were concerned. Is this true?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, sometimes showing an ankle, you can get a lot of mileage out of that.
All right, so this one is going to really stretch, but that's too bad.
Get it?
It is a movie called The Empire Strikes Back.
Wait, is it like Luke in the Bacta tank?
Wait, do you mean Phantom Menace or C-3PO's parts are showing?
Nope.
You're talking about Luke in the Bacta. Oh, no, I know what you're talking about. I seriously thought you were talking about Luke in the Bacta tank. That's where I went. He's talking about Carrie. What he's talking about? Not Carrie Ann Moss. What that? Oh, Carrie. Thank you for saying Carrie Fisher in the bikini, right?
That's the third one.
Oh, that's the third.
I don't know.
You are talking about Luke in the Bacta tank. You're talking about being able to see Mark Hamill's chest.
No, I'm not.
What nudity is in Empire Strikes Back?
Chewbacca's schlongs in it.
Yeah, it is schlong. Let me tell you. Is between that and the big blue one. All right, no. The moment, it probably takes less than a second of screen time. And it's, you're going to kill me for this. It's the naked skull of Darth Vader.
I like that. I like that, Kelly Wand. He's got a good thing going. Go ahead, Dingus.
All right.
And the thing is, I remember I was in a fairly religious family when I was growing up, and I remember driving home from church after it's at about the time when I was just between films, and Empire Strikes Back had a big impact on me because it was such a cliffhanger, and I just thought about it all the time. And on the way home from church one day, I said to my parents in the car, there's one person I hate besides Satan, of course, and that is Darth Vader. And I just felt such anger. And no, actually, this was before seeing Empire Strikes Back. I'm sorry. And then you have that moment when I don't even know who it is. I think it's Piet, but I'm not sure, who walks in to tell him that the Emperor needs to talk to him on the phone. And Darth Vader's in his meditation chamber, and his helmet is coming down, and you see the back of his scarred skull. It's this naked head. And up until this point, I had just thought of Darth Vader as this remorseless machine of evil. Yeah. And you get this sense of this broken creature inside. And I'd never thought of it that way. I just thought of him as evil incarnate that I hated. And I was forced to look at him as this gnarled, scarred, and it really is like a second. I can't even remember how long it is, but it made such an impression on me. And when I was thinking of this list, this is the first thing that came to mind.
Well done, Dingus.
So it looks like a penis to you.
Yes, exactly. It's the head. Good way to focus on that. And also the guy, and I think it's Piet, he just gives this wince before you see it. It's this awful look on his face, and then you see the head. And yeah, no penis imagery was intended, Mr. Wand.
Oh. So you were like Piet, where he leaves the room right after that, and guys, you never guess what I just saw.
My number three is a movie that, I don't know, have you guys seen Observe and Report, the thing directed by Jody Hill? Yeah, it was Seth Rogen. It's obviously a movie that was intended to have Danny McBride in it. It didn't, so it suffered. I'm not crazy about the movie. But the movie is about a mall cop. Danny McBride, who they couldn't get, so they get Seth Rogen, is supposed to be a mall cop, and one of the early plot lines is there's a flasher out in the parking lot, and you see the flasher, you know, it's just the standard shot from behind, the guy in the overcoat, and he opens his overcoat, and the camera's behind him, so you don't see anything. There's not going to be, like, a naked dude there. And the women are shocked, and they run off and scream. And this happens a couple of times, and it's sort of about one of the plot lines is him trying to solve the issue of this flasher who's terrorizing women at the mall. So the movie goes on, and stupid things happen, and it's not that good. I mean, Jody Hill's much better movie is Foot Fist Way or Eastbound and Down, both of which have the good fortune to have Danny McBride. This movie doesn't. So, but as it's going on, eventually near the end, there's a chase scene where Seth Rogen chases the flasher, and in slow motion, the guy's coat is flapping open, his dude bits are dangling around, and it's a chase scene played to the soundtrack of the Pixies song, Where Is My Mind? It's not the Pixies, though, it's someone doing a cover. And anybody who has seen Fight Club knows that song. And it's just this really literally ballsy scene of male nudity. And it's crass and stupid and juvenile and really gross because the guy's like 40 years old and out of shape and ugly and it's so incredibly appropriate for the movie that I just had to applaud them doing that. So that's my number three. Kelly Wand, am I the only one here who's seen Observe and Report?
No, I want to see it. I'm a Seth Rogen apologist, actually.
Well, you need to put that on your list then.
Did you guys just hear my phone ring again? It's the second podcast in a row.
Did not, but you're a popular guy. It's probably Roland Emmerich wanting to take lunch with you. Kelly Wand, number two, favorite instance of nudity.
Well, see, I'm now realizing that one reason Requiem for a Dream was on there was because I felt I needed one chick at least on my list. Just to.
I was thinking of a lot of dudes too, and not in a.
And now I'm noticing, yeah. I think now maybe that's the only girl on any of our lists.
I had
because
to.
Male nudity is so much rarer.
Exactly. Exactly. So
number two, which Dingus kind of ruined a minute ago, is Watchmen with its blue paints of Dr. Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was a very. Awesome touch, because it was, I guess what makes this list for me or any list is something where it reveals something about the character, and the idea that there was this gigantic blue cock on the screen, which he didn't care about, just symbolized what godhood would feel like.
Yeah, nice. And there's even doesn't...
it's like there was a black monolith coming out of his crotch.
And doesn't Nixon tell him to put on pants? Isn't that in the movie?
Yeah, but he ignores it. Or, I know, he doesn't ignore it.
No, because the...
It's like a flag pen.
Well, in the Vietnam sequence, when he's a giant, he has some sort of a loincloth. And we did sort of assume that Nixon would be like, that's great, but... yeah.
That's a good one, too. Very good.
Because this is for the cover of Time magazine, so you need to cover up.
All right.
But, I mean, I think... I get this. I considered Zack Snyder a real hack until I saw that penis on screen, and I went, "Oh, he fought. He won this battle with the studio, and now he'll never win another battle again for the rest of his life."
That's true. Yeah. Now, do you know Kelly Wand for a fact if like there was pressure for him to not include that from the comic? Because that's in the comic, right? I haven't read it, but isn't Dr. Manhattan?
It's in the comic, and I remember reading they were trying to make it look more subdued, and everything's way worse than we ever think it is. And what little experience I've had with Warner Brothers, they're a little uptight. But, you know, it was just so worth it. Like, it really didn't need to be in the movie. And the fact that it was said a lot about
They could have cut around it, or they could have done the stupid Austin Powers thing where there was always something in front of his.
Right. Exactly. But they chose not to. And people walked out of that movie. I saw it twice because I had to appease different factions of nerds. But. Both times I saw it, people walked out like right after the blue penis comes out, and I was just so pleased with it.
Yeah, that was a brave movie on a number of levels, and that was definitely one of them. Dingus, what is your number two favorite instance of nudity?
First of all, a lot of people seem to walk out of the movies Kelly's seeing.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Well, I wear a raincoat, and I fart a lot.
All right, that's fine. All right, my number two is a movie called Witness. And there were a lot of possible movies on this list, but this one is I was on a first date in high school, and the girl I was with was from another school, and she was older than me. She had a college boyfriend, and she was sort of trying me out as maybe the new guy. And we went to this because we had heard that it was going to be romantic. I don't know that even then I thought Kelly McGillis was that hot or anything. But the moment when she's bathing herself, she's doing the sponge bath, and she senses that Harrison Ford sees her, and she turns around. I don't know if it was the circumstance that there was already a great deal of sexual tension going on there for me, or if that is actually in that scene. But I felt like I was holding my breath for the rest of the night.
Well, it's an Amish woman bathing, which is even hotter.
Yeah, exactly. She's a hot Amish woman. There's a great deal of sexual repression, which I think I can speak to. And just that moment between the two of them where nothing happens and then they have to deal with that later. And it just knocked me out, and it really, really stuck with me.
Is that when you did the popcorn trick from Diner on your first date?
No, I did that in Empire Strikes Back, actually.
Dingus, this sounds like it could have made your company you keep list as well.
Yeah, but I didn't even think of it until it came up this week.
Okay.
Dingus is quite a player. He sees a lot of movies on.
Does Witness hold up? It's Peter Weir. Is Witness still – and isn't Danny Glover like the bad guy? Am I right about that, or did I just make that up?
Yeah, he's the bad cop, yeah. I think.
Is Witness still good? Maybe I should Netflix Witness again.
I didn't like Witness when I saw it, and I've never seen it again. But I remember there's that silo. He beats them with a corn silo, and then he goes, "All right, come on, this is getting crazy. Let's stop trying to shoot each other." And then they do. And I remember thinking that was retarded at the time.
But he also grabs Lucas Haas. Is it Lucas Haas?
Yeah, Lucas Haas. Before he trolled out for Brick.
I want to think that it does hold up. I have a hankering to see that and Mosquito Coast, because I have very fond memories of Mosquito Coast. It's a flawed film, but I really felt that it was one of my favorite performances. And also it has Helen Mirren in it. So I'd really like to see Witness and Mosquito Coast. I have no idea if they hold up, but the image of Kelly McGillis sponge bathing herself and turning around and being this naked Amish woman really kind of knocked me out.
Well, my number two is an obscure movie that, like Observe and Report, no one here will have seen. Actually, all three of my movies, nobody has seen. My number two is a movie that I actually know Dingus has seen. Kelly, if you haven't seen it, you need to see a movie called Vinyan.
Vinyan.
Oh, I was so close.
I thought I might preempt you. Vinyan is a combination of Apocalypse Now and Don't Look Now. It's about a couple who... basically goes on a reckless journey into the jungle to try to find their child. It's a horror movie, thriller, kind of weird thing. And Emmanuel Baird is in it. She's amazing. And she, just as an actress, she's phenomenal in this. And the ending has – it's got this whole sort of weird motif of going from being like wet and clean to in the mud. And the final instance of nudity with Emmanuel Baird is just it's beautiful, it's disconcerting, and it is incredibly thematically appropriate.
We just have to take your word for that.
You do, because say
until
more,
now it sounds like you violated your own rules. Sounds like the hot chick scene.
But that's the thing, is it's not. She's incredibly. That's not why the nudity is great. The nudity is great for how disconcerting and appropriate it is. It's all context, and to say more would spoil it. But suffice to say, I think Vinyan is an amazing movie. It's from a French director who did a weird horror movie called La Calvaire, which I don't recommend. But this is almost – it has. So this is basically a weird French horror movie director combining Don't Look Now with Apocalypse Now, and it has Emmanuel Baird in an amazing instance of nudity.
And she's playing the role of the crazy dwarf at the end of Don't Look Now.
I don't want to spoil anything.
You are really wise not to spoil that moment, because it is one of those. I'm thinking of the first two things we did where that final moment in a movie really does something to you.
Yeah,
that's a great one.
Yeah. So
V-I-N-Y-O-N.
V-I-N-Y-A-N. It's a Thai word for a ghost, basically.
Ah.
And disconcerting, I don't know if that word even comes close to how I felt, but that's all I'm going to say.
All right,
that's a great choice. That's a great choice, Tom.
I've never heard that tone in Dingus's voice before. I hear it all the time in yours.
Yeah.
Now I'm excited. Now
you'll immediately grok why that tone is there when you see it, Kelly. You know me well enough by now.
Okay.
All right, so Kelly Wand, what's your number one favorite instance of nudity in a movie?
My number one, it's another sausage-related one. it's David Cronenberg's masterpiece of masterpieces, Eastern Promises.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
I should have thought of that. That is awesome, Kelly Wand.
With the fight in the sauna. And to me, that's the essence of acting, is when you're doing a fight scene nude with another actor, and it's super violent and brutal. And
it makes that fight scene, doesn't it? I mean, if they just had the towels conveniently draped over them the whole time, it would have been
ridiculous.
Just get
the sense that they were willing to risk hurting themselves really badly to shoot that scene, and it's an amazing scene.
Well, and there's got to be some fancy CG stuff, too, with the knife, because they show like blades going into flat. I mean,
it's a knife fight.
It's a knife fight, and there are no punches pulled, and you can just the slapping flesh and the groping. I mean, it's just wow, that's awesome, Kelly Wand. Good one.
All right, good.
Man, I might have to change mine now.
Because I was a little embarrassed by my Watchmen, and I knew I'd get nailed on Requiem for a Dream because you don't see any bush. Although you do in another scene in that.
Wow, that's like that. So one of the worst, and before we continue, I think of like bad instances of nudity. Actually, this might be someone's number one pick, so I won't say anything until we're done.
Well, it can only be Dingus's or no one's.
Dingus, is your number one pick, your number one favorite instance of nudity, Julianne Moore running around without pants and shortcuts?
While
she has an argument with Matthew Modine.
Too easy.
Hold on.
Now, Dingus picks weird ones. That's what's cool about his lists.
Can you give me a moment?
Did that just change your plans for the evening?
No, actually, the Watchmen one did.
So what is your number one? Now that you can't pick Eastern Promises, Dingus, what is your number one favorite instance of nudity?
Well, first of all, I just want to say, Kelly, I had thought about History of Violence, actually, and thought about some of the scenes in that, and I didn't even think about Eastern Promises. That's awesome.
I think that's what led me to it, because I thought of the sex scene in History of Violence, and then went, it's a sex scene, they'll just pound on me. And then wait, pounding? Penis?
Don't say that. Yeah. Thank you. And isn't there something about that where Viggo Mortensen decided late in the game to do that, where it was sort of like a game day decision?
To do it nude?
I don't know. I haven't...
Yeah, that they both... Him and David Cronenberg both said, I think we have to do it this way. And they just worked it out.
Wow, nice.
Am I wrong?
I don't know. I'd like to look that up.
All right, well,
let's
my
say
number
it's
one...
true for now.
All right, that's fine.
And then the listeners can care.
All right, my number one, and I went back and forth between two films, and I'm not going to say the other one, so I'll just say the one that I chose, is the film Birth. And the moment for me, I am just crazy about this movie. It's when Nicole Kidman is in the bathtub and Cameron Bright comes into the room and gets into the bathtub with her.
Oh.
And she, it's this, and I mean, there's two bathtub scenes, but this first one, it's just this amazing moment for me in cinema. It's shocking. It's scary to me. It's got this edge of the seat quality. It's sad. There's this weird maternal kind of romantic.
It's hard to find Nicole Kidman naked in a movie too.
And she's she just looks waifish and bony. It just shows her from the back and her spine. And I don't particularly think she's sexy, but him climbing into the bathtub, and he's so modest and scared and protective of himself. He sits sideways in the bathtub, and they're very careful with how they shoot it. But given what's going on in the movie, there's this unbelievable weird tension there, and and he is amazing. He's just an amazing actor when he's properly handled. He's sitting there protecting himself and declaring she's his wife, and then you jump to that later scene where she has that wonderful line where she says, I don't know if I should even say the line because I don't want to ruin it for people who haven't seen it, but it takes my breath away whenever I think about that movie.
Very nice. That one was close, but the reason that I didn't put that, well, and also I liked my other ones, but I don't, like, there isn't actual nudity there. Like, you don't actually see, there's nothing salacious about it. Like, it's shot where you don't recall, oh, there's Nicole Kidman's breast.
It's nuder than Darth Vader's head, though.
They're completely naked. Both of them are completely naked in a bathtub together, and it's just an amazing situation, and you can't believe it. And this is a moment that a lot of people cite as why the movie is abhorrent to them.
Right.
And I understand that, but I don't think they're really paying attention to the movie and how careful I think the filmmakers must have been to protect this boy, boy actor. For me, it's because it's so shocking and sad and scary to me, it really had an impact on me.
Good, good. That's a good one.
You're a sucker for anything with a kid in it.
Well, yeah, but the other one had kids in it too, and so I chose between two kid moments, and luckily I had at least one woman who was naked in this list.
So, out of curiosity, what movie lost out?
I think I'll let you do yours, and then I'll let you know.
You haven't even seen mine.
You guys just did that to each other.
All right. Well, I thought for sure. Okay. it would have been the other one that I was considering was Let the Right One In.
What? Oh, that's a good one. That's serviceable.
Wait, what?
Thanks.
When is someone naked in that?
That was the part that ruined the movie for Tom.
Oh, that! Right, exactly. Oh my God, I don't even think of that as nudity. Wow, yeah, that just so...
Because he totally did not understand that moment until people could explain it to him. But it's not just that moment. It's this moment where she also climbs into bed with him. And she's cold and naked, and they're both naked in bed together. And then there's that later moment, which is just stunning.
So, okay.
If you understand.
So here's the thing is you're talking about nudity. Like, those are fine, and those are good. But what I was sort of thinking is when the audience actually gets to see nudity, they don't normally get to see. So that's part of why, and Let the Right One In does have that weird, disconcerting shot that recasts everything. But that's part of why, like, in a way, I don't think of, like, Birth, that's very clearly, that's a scene that's partly about nudity. But the audience doesn't really get to see, there's no titillation there. Like,
so you're disqualifying Darth
Vader. Well, I'm not, no. I think.
He's naked in his armor, Tom.
No, but you were very clear about it. It could be any body part.
No, I know. I'm just sort of saying how my sort of thought process.
Not our first broken list.
I'm just sort of thinking how my thought process went in terms of thinking of my three. Like, where things where, in Observe and Report, you see the guy's actual, like, dingleberry flopping around. And in Vinyan, there's an actual, you can see actual nudity. So those are good picks, Dingus. I'm not trying to disqualify them. I'm just sort of saying, like to me, it's when the filmmaker actually shows something that's, like, going to get him an R rating or that's...
So Requiem for a Dream should count.
Well, that's part of one, too, is that's why I sort of said I don't recall. Like, I don't think you could see much in that scene. More was suggested in that scene.
I did originally think of something like a Bad Lieutenant.
Right.
But then I felt like I was just going for genitals instead of nudity.
Well, yeah, so that's what I'm saying. Is my scenes are all, like, explicit graphic nudity. It's sort of what was cataloging in my head when I was thinking about this.
Only genitals count.
Those are great picks, Dingus. I'm not trying to disqualify what you've done, just sort of like why that sort of thing didn't really occur to me. And that's what's great about 3x3 is we all sort of come at it with different priorities. So my number one pick is a movie that neither of you has seen called The War Zone, that was directed by Tim Roth. And there are two specific instances of nudity, one of which is just incredibly shocking, and it's not my favorite. I mean, it's really brave. It might be too much. I don't know how I feel about that, but that's not the one that I specifically think of when I'm thinking of this list. My probably all-time favorite instance of nudity is The War Zone with Tilda Swinton having just given birth, and she was actually had just given birth as an actress, like in real life recently, and there's a scene where she's nursing a baby, and she looks like, an older woman who's just had a baby, and it's just so natural. It's about a family in rural England. And it's just so completely like throwaway. And she's so sort of brave because she's not in shape. And it's just natural and it's real and it's part of what this movie does so well. And it makes me really sad that Tim Roth hasn't directed more movies.
Was she actually nursing?
Yeah. She was nursing at the time, like in real life.
And Me, Myself, and Irene, where Jim Carrey sucks on the buxomy chick's boob, she was actually nursing.
I'm afraid I have not seen that movie. Thanks for spoiling it.
I actually have seen The War Zone, and that is quite a stunning moment, actually.
Oh, you have? Oh. Yeah. When did you see that?
Because there's a baby involved, so he see it.
You suggested it after we saw something at Sundance, and I can't for the life of me remember what it was.
Okay.
I don't know if it was that awful Tilda Swinton movie about the girl who gives birth to a baby in a trash can, or if it was something else. But there was something we saw where you said you have to see The War Zone for a better instance of this.
Oh, good.
And yeah, that's a really good one, actually.
So, and it's mild. It's not like a big in-your-face thing, and that's part of why I liked it too. It's just, you know what? Here's an actress who's a mother playing a mother suckling a child, and let's just do it. It's like, you know what? It's like those sex scenes where afterwards the actress has the sheet up to her, you know, her clavicle. So,
did the carpet match the drapes?
Tilda Swinton was not pantless. You're thinking again of Julianne Moore. You're going back to that.
Oh, yeah. I get the mixed up. Sorry.
Well, this does get me in mind of like of the worst instances of nudity, but maybe that can be for a later list.
No. We're not going to do these like inverse list things. Kelly Wand, if your pick this week was worst instances of
nudity. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. So did I tell you guys I saw did I mention this horror movie last week? What was it? Wrong Turn 3.
What? There's three of them?
Yeah, there's three of them. And there's a sex scene. It's like early on in the movie because the C-level actors that they hired to be the main actors, they're not going to be taking their clothes off. So they hire some random woman to be the, you know, like Chrissy in Jaws. She's the chick who gets killed early on. You kill someone early on to show, you know, here's the terrible thing, killing people. So in the beginning of Wrong Turn, these two people are having sex. And the dude has his hand on a woman's breast. And the hillbillies, who they kill people with a bow and arrow, shoot an arrow through the woman's back into her breast and impale the dude's hand while it's on her breast.
That's kind of good.
And it was just this instance of, okay, we have to get, before the movie starts in earnest, we have to get nudity and gore and some.
So she has to be standing up for that to happen.
She's astride him. I don't want to get too graphic. So, but that was like, come on, you guys, that's so cheap. That's what you guys are going to do?
I'm surprised they haven't done it before this.
Maybe they have. You know, there's the
that's
famous.
That's more original and creative than anything in 2012.
Well, there's the famous scene from the first Friday the 13th where Kevin Bacon.
I'd love to have seen the caldera meteor go through a breast in 2012.
There's the famous scene in Friday the 13th where Kevin Bacon gets the arrow pushed up through his throat. And, you know, that I think is sort of where that sort of thing starts.
Remember the eye in Zombie?
I don't.
Okay, is that eye violence?
Yeah. Islands.
Oh, nice. Can I give my favorite nudity quote?
Yeah. What's a good nudity quote?
All right. Let's see if you can. I'm going to give the quote, and you, Tom, have to give the response.
Okay.
Let's see if we can do this. Do I have to take off the rest of my clothes, or can I leave them on, John?
I'm thinking.
Good job.
That's an easy one. But that is a good one. That's a great nudity quote. Kelly Wand, are you a fan of Constantine, like Dingus and I are?
Oh, is that from that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that movie. You talked me into liking it. You made me like
good.
It.
I'm glad I brought it
up. Even though it's not very true to the original comic book, which I read because I'm a nerd.
It's
supposed to be Irish.
And blonde. That's right. How dare they?
But it's a good movie. I like how he outwits Satan.
Any movie where the ending is a conversation between Peter Stormare and Tilda Swinton, where that's the climax of the movie, I'm all for it. More movies should end that way. Kelly Wand, you've been thinking about our next 3x3. What do you have for us?
All right. this one might suck. So if it does, know that I have a couple more in the chamber.
You've got to, whatever you put out there, you've got to commit to.
Well, if you guys go, ugh,
we might, but
just know I can do another.
Okay, we're not going to. No, you are in charge here, Kelly Wand.
Well, because this one might be another of your more about us than the movies, and maybe no one cares.
But you know what? That's fine, Kelly Wand. You are 1/3 of this podcast. Nobody has veto power. You now have the conch. You determine what our 3x3 is.
I don't like authority, and I don't like having authority.
The conch.
Yeah, what's that? Is that British?
Are you supposed to say that instead of conch? I think I was corrected once on conch, and I believe the person who tried to correct me. Have I been going around sounding silly all these years?
It's con.
Con?
No, the shell. You have the con. I'm doing a Lord of the Flies reference, not a Star Trek reference, dingus.
Conch.
You have the conch.
What do you call the... All right, you're fine.
Wait, so I'm the pig's head? Because that's trading up. I settle. I'm totally satisfied. That's true. I'm piggy.
Oh, you have the conch is awesome.
Well, how do you say it? Right. Hold on. How do you say it?
No, you said it right.
Oh, shut up. Kelly Wand, save us. What do you got for us?
Orchestral. My stupid list for 3x3. Wait, do I have to explain what 3x3 is? Because I think that's boring.
We know by now because we just did one. I think we've right. established.
Well, I thought we knew when I had to do this last time, and I got in trouble for not explaining. It's the number 3 in movies. It's all very complicated.
Spoiler alert, you'll get in trouble every time, no matter what you do.
I know. I'm an idiot. I deserve trouble. My list, though, for this week, listeners heed, is 3, quote, classic movies that everyone has seen but you, and why. Like 3 great movies that everyone likes. Maybe I'm the only one who'll have a list because you guys actually have seen some.
I like that idea. I think that's a great idea.
No? Yes?
No,
come
no,
on.
No, I think that's a great idea. What are you talking about? Save your bitter ones for later. This podcast, we're going to be doing this in perpetuity. So,
But you guys were dead silent after I said that. Which
no, because I was immediately thinking about what the word classic meant and my wheels started turning.
Yeah.
So great.
Good list. All right. All right, and Dingus, why don't you tell everyone what movie we'll be seeing next week? Because I've forgotten. What did we decide? Actually, this was your pick, Dingus. This is your pick, so you introduce the movie next week.
Should I be coy about it the way Kelly is and pretend we don't really know yet? All right, the movie we're going to see for next week, keeping with this week's blockbuster, we're going to see another blockbuster called An Education.
All right. So if you want to listen to us next week and not have us spoil the movie for you, between now and then, make sure to have seen An Education. And we'll be back with Kelly Wand's 3x3 of classic movies we haven't seen and why. So that's it. Thank you for joining us, and we will talk to everyone in a week.
Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.